start with some brief introductions. My name is Allison Haddock. I'm the chair of the State Legislative Committee, and I wanted to thank everyone for being on the call. As we've heard in the last couple minutes, we've got great representation from around the country on the call, and we're hoping for an opportunity to talk about some key issues that we've identified, as well as hear from some of you if you have important issues that are related to these issues that haven't made it on the agenda. So if everyone could mute their line, you can either use the mute function on your phone or star 6 should work. That'll help cut down on the noise because we're hearing a lot of clicks and clacks and background noise. And as we get to our content, I want to make sure the speakers have as clear of a time as possible. To start us off, I do want to remind everyone about the Leadership and Advocacy Conference because it's sneaking up on us a little faster than usual this year. The events are going to start on March 12th and go through March 15th. So if you haven't already made your travel plans, now is the time to get that going. We'll be talking about a lot of the issues that we're discussing on this call in a bit more detail. So with that, I think I'm ready to transition to Gordon Wheeler if he's on the call now.
I am, Dr. Haddock. Thank you.
All right, perfect. Thank you.
So here we are sitting in Washington, D.C., roughly a week and a half to go before the inauguration, which is January 20th, a Friday. That'll coincide with probably one of the largest demonstrations during an inaugural in recent history, people in opposition to the president-elect. But right now, if you're watching C-SPAN or any of the other TV networks, you'll see that the confirmation hearing process has started. There will be 7 hearings this week. The one that I was just seeing earlier today was Jeff Sessions, who, as you know, was nominated to serve as Attorney General. We believe that the nominee for the Department of Health and Human Services, Dr. Tom Price, congressman from Georgia, and also the chair, current chair, or was the chair of the House Budget Committee, will probably go through confirmation hearings next week. I don't know when there'll be hearings for other positions within HHS, such as for Seema Verma, who is the Indiana expert on Medicaid, who has been nominated to serve as CMS administrator. So more on that to come. Meanwhile, I think the big talk right today in Washington is the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. You probably recall during the campaign that then-candidate Trump repeatedly said he wanted to see the act repealed and replaced. It could be done on the same day. Republicans in the House in particular don't believe that can happen. They think maybe repeal can happen relatively soon. But whatever it is that will replace the Affordable Care Act hasn't been crafted or agreed upon by Republicans in the House or the Senate, and consequently, they're not ready to go. The president-elect has indicated that that's unacceptable to him. So how they're going to work that out, I do not know. Many groups have offered up comments on what's going on. ASAP developed a letter, which Dr. Parker sent to the Hill, and included with the letter was an attachment of principles. I can make that available to everybody. It should also be on the website. We're not taking a firm position on repeal, just as the college did not take a position when the Affordable Care Act was moving through, but we did make it very clear that there were certain things that were critical that needed to be addressed, and those include, of course, a fundamental point of access to emergency medical services. And as Dr. Haddock successfully pointed out to the Federal Affairs Committee, that we wanted to reiterate ASAP's policy that ASAP supports health care coverage for all. We think all Americans should have health care coverage. So that debate, I think, probably will drag on. There'll be a vote potentially in the Senate on Thursday to approve a budget process by which repeal could ultimately occur. If that bill passes the Senate on Thursday, it could go to the House of Representatives on Friday, and then that'll start the process to get a repeal bill developed that will not require the 60-vote majority that most other filibuster-breaking bills would require. It actually only requires a simple majority. There are 52 Republicans in the Senate, rather, with the Vice President Pence who could break a tie if there were one. So that's sort of what's going to be happening in the next couple of weeks. The Federal Government Affairs Committee annually develops as one of its objectives a legislative and regulatory agenda. That agenda is then, once it's approved by the committee, forwarded to the board of directors, and then the board considers it and we hope approves it. And that'll be happening a week from Thursday. The board should take up and pass our agenda. I can circulate that to you all as well. Many of the items will look very familiar, not the least of which would be the liability bill related relief liability bill that Charlie Dent has introduced in the past. So that'll again be introduced. There are a lot of other things we're working on. We had actually for a Congress that did not get a lot done last year. We saw a number of things that were enacted that we're very pleased with. The 21st Century Cures Bill, that included a provision that deals with data blocking by health IT vendors, also money for and planning for mental health and a series of other issues. So the 114th Congress wasn't altogether a washout. This Congress promises to be busy. They're going to try and actually, I think, initially work more than 3 or 4 days a week, maybe even 5. Will be all leading up to, of course, ultimately, for us in early March, the Leadership and Advocacy Conference, and we hope to have a good turnout for that. I'm sure maybe Allison was talking about that when I came on the phone. But we will again be doing a full day on the Hill on March 14 with a reception on Capitol Hill. And we're going to try again to do dine-arounds. And those are, for those of you not familiar, those are where we try to have basically a dinner or a reception with a member of Congress and as many members from ASAP as we can get to participate. So we did one for Oregon, and we had Ron Wyden, the ranking Democrat on the Finance Committee. We had probably about 15 people, very successful. So we'll be doing a number of those, one for Congressman Teaberry, maybe for Congressman Burgess, one for Raul Ruiz. I did want to mention, since I just mentioned Congressman Ruiz from California, as you know, we were supporting both Congressman Ruiz and Congressman Joe Heck, who was at the time running for the United States Senate for the seat being vacated by Harry Reid. Unfortunately, he lost, but Raul did win re-election, and just as importantly, he's now going to be on a very critical committee, the House Energy and Commerce Committee. So we're very pleased about that. And then Congressman Burgess from Texas is going to be the chairman of the Health Subcommittee of that same big committee. So those are two very good things for emergency medicine. So we'll be working closely with them. And as I say, we're going to do a couple of events for them during LAC. The program at LAC, we hope to have the Secretary of HHS is our lunch speaker. We also hope to have the administrator, if she's confirmed by then, of CMS. And just as interestingly, we have a performer, a physician, who goes by the name Z-Dog. He's Dr. Zubin Demedia, and he will be performing from 4:30 to 6 on Monday. And that should be a very interesting. Dr. Parker and I spoke with him. I think a lot of you know he deals with resiliency and burnout, so it should be a good session. And then we have lobby day on Tuesday, but we'll have training before that, and then leadership day basically on Wednesday. So it looks like a good program. Turnout, we hope to be good. We're working that as well. Unfortunately, I guess we have a conflict this year with Florida, but we understand that. But in the future, we're going to go back to the more late April, May timeframe. Because that seems like we've heard from a lot of people are disappointed that it's being held this early. That was done for contract reasons, and we couldn't really change it, but we will be doing that going forward. So happy to answer any questions.
Does that mean that the dates that are already out, leadership and advocacy for the next 3 years, they will change? Do you mean after that?
Yes, I believe the date will change for next for the 2018. I don't know about 19, but it is our intent to move back to the more traditional. Somebody put their phone on mute. Very hard to hear with the. But I'll confirm that for you. Who was that who asked that question?
Laura T-Berry.
Okay, I'll confirm that to you, Laura.
Does anyone else have any questions for Gordon about federal issues that are impacting the state? All right, hearing none for now, we're going to move forward on our agenda on to the very hot topic of out-of-network and balanced billing. Chip Pettigrew was anticipated to be our initial speaker, but he's actually meeting with the legislator right now, so he's a little bit delayed. So we're going to hear from the other speakers and then check and see if he's on the call. If he's not able to be on the call yet at that point, we might need to add him back in at the end. So our first speaker would be Bruce Moskow talking about Texas's political headwinds. Bruce, are you here?
I am here. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Good. So the only balanced bill affecting bill that's been filed so far comes from the chairman of the committee that would actually that all these bills would run through. And his is basically adjusting the mediation that we already have, make it extended to a number of physician specialties that weren't included, and streamlining, at least in his mind, how that process would work. It's not a terrible bill for us. If that's the only thing that passes this session, we would be pretty happy. But it's still, you know, very early, and there'll be a number of other bills filed, and so we're really waiting to see. There's been no real push from the plans so far. They've indicated in private that their priority is pushing back on the pharmaceutical companies, and that's going to be their legislative priority. But a number of old TMA lobbyists that had been on our side have moved to Blue Cross, and so there may be, besides what the plans do collectively, there may be an independent move on the part of Blue Cross, so we'll be waiting to see what they do. So session started today, it goes for 140 days, and we'll just see if we can ride it out.
Thank you, Bruce. I think that's a pretty good summary of where we're at in Texas, and I'm sure there will be updates to come over the next 140 days. Does anyone have any questions for Bruce? All right. Sorry, Dr. Moskow. I'm hearing none. I'll move on to Dr. Doshi to talk about Pennsylvania's experience with out-of-network billing.
Thank you very much. Our experience is kind of similar but different in some ways. In the last year, the concept of out-of-network billing was brought up by the insurance commissioner of the state, not strictly through the legislature, but obviously would need to go through there. And they had a wide-ranging set of concerns about balanced billing, out-of-network billing, and emergency medicine was a part of that. Their proposed executive information talks about mediation and talks about billing and is really wide-ranging and fairly detrimental to our specialty. What we've done in the last year is testified at a Senate Insurance Committee hearing, at the Insurance Commissioner's own hearing, and we were the only physician specialty to testify at that hearing. We have got a lot of actually decent feedback from her office about this and about how emergency medicine is not really maybe where they were attempting to focus this legislation on, and at least some willingness to work out with us on any legislation as it would come forward. We kind of think it's still important to be very involved with our other specialty groups and have met already with the Pennsylvania Society of Anesthesiologists and have actually, I think it's next week, and Cicely Elliott's on the phone, our exec, in case I say something wrong, would be meeting with a multi-specialty group through PA Med about our unified kind of approach to this concept. So we're hitting at it starting with the physicians group at this point and also going directly with the insurance commissioner. Our session, legislative session, has not started yet. There was no sponsor for a specific bill in the last session, and we don't know if it's going to go through the insurance commissioner to draft with the governor's office and then to the legislature, but that's where I think I suspect it'll go through. That's how it's gone through for other health bills recently. So with that, I'll take any questions.
All right. Hearing the questions right now for Dr. Doshi. Dr. Chip Pettigrew, were you able to be on the call yet? He didn't anticipate being able to be on until after the half-hour mark. So at this point, I think we can open it up to if any other states have out-of-network balance billing legislation that they would like to address, and then we'll come back at the towards the end of the call when Dr. Pettigrew is able to be on to discuss the Georgia situation. So is there anyone from any other state that would like to? Perfect. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Suzanne, contract lobbyist in Colorado. We have had great legislation here for quite some time that basically holds the patient harmless and requires the health plan to either negotiate a rate or pay billed charges. The health plans led by Aetna are coming in saying that the physicians are abusing the system, and they're trying to tie out-of-network reimbursement to some percentage of Medicare. We successfully have fought that the last couple of years. This year, we do plan on joining forces with the State Medical Society and introducing legislation that will essentially mirror what National ASAP has done with some of the specialty societies. But I wanted to let you all know that for any of those that copied what we did years ago, it is now really drawing a lot of fire. So we're going to attempt to kind of shore it up and change it so the plans can't claim that we're abusing it. The only evidence they can give, however, is not physician related. They're showing abuse by neuromonitors, ambulatory surgical centers, and surgical assists. So we may call out, you know, a big cry of help, but so far it looks like we might be very successful in pursuing what you all have recommended.
Hey, Allison, this is Ann Zink from Alaska, and we also have an update. So this had not been on the issue until a week before Christmas, and the insurance commissioner said that they were going to introduce some potential legislation and had a public hearing. For those who are not familiar, Alaska since 2004 has had an 80th percentile ruling. So basically what's geographically determined to be the 80th percentile for those charges are required to be paid by the health insurance agency, and the health insurance, particularly Premier Blue Cross, is that the only left insurer in the private market here in Alaska, states that this is the reason for quadrupling healthcare and quadrupling insurance premiums since 2004. So there was an open hearing that came about this past Thursday. It was incredibly heated and intense, but was a lot of good perspectives. We actually had 1 out of 10 emergency physicians practicing in the state wrote a letter, and we had 4 emergency physicians speak live in testimony to that, and it was a really great, I think, collaborative effort. We are proposing that we be willing to negotiate on a ban on balance billing, really because none of the ERs are, if we continue to hold the 80th percentile rule, somewhat modeling after what legislation has done and similar models what Washington State is trying to put in there. So it's a hot topic right now in the state, I think primarily driven by the one left private insurer, but that's the current status in Alaska and has become a sudden big issue.
And this is Amanda signed.
I'm sorry, this is Suzanne in Colorado again. We are going to look at going to the 80th percentile. Are you suggesting that that is not working for the physicians?
No, we're suggesting from emergency physicians it does work very well and works great. The insurance agencies are saying that this is driving up costs, So particularly in our state where there's a limited number of providers, less so in emergency medicine, but particularly in cardiac care as well as orthopedic care, they are stating that if anyone has greater than 20% of the market, they can basically price fix the market by saying this is what is geographically set. We are saying if there are monopolies or certain groups that they're concerned about, then they can go about those individually. But we felt like this was a good patient protection and consumer protection issue that has been serving emergency medicine well. So we think it has been working well in this state. We actually, if you look at the Fair Health database for Alaska, our prices are actually below other areas, despite the fact that our healthcare premiums on general are twice the national average. And so we brought up kind of those statistics. So I think from an emergency medicine standpoint, the 80th percentile makes a lot of sense. I'd be happy to send people our letter that kind of delineates where that is and why we think it makes a lot of sense.
Is that 80th percentile of Fair Health?
What's that? Sorry, I didn't understand the question.
Is that 80th percentile of Fair Health?
So if you look at the actual legislation, it's 80th percentile of geographically determined. We, in our testimony, use the Fair Health database to talk about those numbers, and that's what we have been using for a billing practice standpoint. Some of the other groups, particularly the hospitalists and some of the procedure-based groups, have some pushback with Fair Health specifically because they don't believe the data is robust enough. We say that it is robust, and from an emergency standpoint, think that the numbers are fine.
Thank you.
And I've got a statement. We've been working closely with the Alaska Hospital Association as well as the Medical Association in the state. The radiologists hired lobbyists over this. There's been a lot of money and movement on this topic here recently. And I'm happy to send, you know, to Allison or Gordon or Harry a summary. And it's got the Alaska Medical Association comments on it. It has the actual ruling, and it has our statement, if that's helpful to anybody, because I do think this is where a lot of states are looking at going.
I think a lot of states would be interested in that. So if you could share it with Harry, then he could share it with interested parties.
Yep. And I'm always happy to take questions or email on kind of where the insurance company has been blocking this. And they really had a lot of misinformation at the testimony. They quoted in-network prices rather than Fair Health prices when they were comparing apples to apples. And they've actually been going around to individual patients and had them talk about why their cost of health care was so bad and were really specifically blaming doctors. And so we tried to really kind of separate those two out in the meeting. But it's gotten pretty nasty quickly.
This is Claudine Leone, contract lobbyist at New Jersey. We've been doing this for 8 years, so I could add a lot, but I'll just focus maybe on some key factors just to look out for. And, you know, everything started in New Jersey just the way your other states have described it. However, you know, we came up against a situation in which we formed a 23-member coalition of all provider groups. And initially, it was really being driven by one large plan in the state. And then they were able to co-op and join with our business and commerce associations, as well as consumer groups like Citizen Action and AARP. So the plans, you know, after several years of doing this on their own, were smart and kind of got the businesses and the consumers to be the face of the issue. And that's where we've lost some footing, I would say, in recent years on the issue. So I would just forewarn everybody, try to get those consumer groups on your side early on. We did try but didn't have success. I think they're a very, very key factor in at least what's going on in our state. And in New Jersey, our bill is focused almost is exclusively focused on inadvertent and emergency out-of-network. So where a patient goes into the hospital that's in-network and gets touched by an out-of-network doc. So one of the things that most recently was changed in our bill in the last year is a mandate that any contracted physician groups, exclusively contracted physician groups with the hospital, also participate in the same plans as the hospital. And that's a provision we're absolutely working aggressively to remove. We're also focused on arbitration and percentages of everything, and we've gone from percentages of Medicare to percentages of Fair Health. But, you know, that's evolving. So we have 2-year sessions here in New Jersey. I wish we had a 60-day session or something, but it's two-year sessions, and we're in our second or last session of our current session. So we probably will see this go on through December at a minimum.
And this is Amanda Sines from Ohio. We had a legislator come to us with a similar proposal to what New Jersey just mentioned, requiring emergency physicians to contract with the same plans as a hospital. So we are also very concerned that we could see that proposal in Ohio. We do have a legislator that we work well with and is favorable towards emergency medicine that is considering introducing a proposal with the Fair Health model just to get out ahead of this other legislator introducing something that would be a non-starter for us. So we are in the beginnings of those conversations and strategizing here in Ohio, but we certainly expect it to be an issue in 2017 for us as well.
One request, Allison, this is Dr. Zink again from Alaska, is potentially having some sort of either ASAP Basecamp database or something on the Fair Health. It would have been really helpful as we were scrambling to get this together to be able to either have a summary of what other states have done or have that legislation kind of in one place or contact. We ended up just kind of using other contacts. But I don't know if maybe we could even create a Basecamp file where people could put these into and then different people can access it, because I think we're going to all need each other's support over the next year.
Absolutely. We'll try and have some more conversations around that issue, how to make documents and research more widely available to everyone. It's always a challenge to make sure it's available to us but not available to anyone who might be on the other side trying to figure out in advance how to fight against us. Are there any other states that would like to talk about their out-of-network responsibility experiences?
Hey, this is Katie from Oregon. Go ahead. Oh, thanks. This is Katie King from Oregon, and I just wanted to say we're facing a similar situation. We'll have at least three or four balance billing bills come up during the next legislative session, which starts in February. And one from the insurance commissioner. We'll have one from the insurance industry, which will tie the rate to 125% of Medicare. And then we're also advocating for the Physicians for Fair Coverage model legislation. And right now we formed a coalition with our medical association and other specialties. And we are working on educating legislators about the Fair Health database.
That's great. Thank you, Katie. And there was another person who wanted to speak.
Hey, this is Beth in Florida. I don't know if anybody's spoken. We just got out of a meeting. So I think Tony's on, our lobbyist. So we went through the balance billing and had the legislation enacted in July, and now we have some insurers that are deciding to pay at Medicare rate. And we recently had the decision made when our Agency for Healthcare Administration made a decision not to choose Fair Health over another organization, and Fair Health did not challenge that. So now we're just going through the discussions of what our next steps should be. So there's going to be pushback from legislators and agencies for healthcare regulation in every state about which database to choose. So that's just a heads up.
How are you all in other states addressing the ERISA issue?
New Jersey already has a balance billing prohibition. So, you know, we're that state that's, you know, the plans are saying that the physicians are taking are abusing that law in charging, you know, so much that the plans have to pay enough to not have the patient balance bill. So our biggest problem, what the biggest complaints are, is, you know, New Jersey, I don't know about other states, but we're like 75-73% self-funded. Plans were pretty saturated that way. So all the examples of that in network charges that are coming forward are ERISA. So our state has tried to capture ERISA by regulating what the physicians can charge versus you know, trying to regulate ERISA. So that's been the biggest holdup, and the intent of the sponsors is to capture ERISA in some way.
Does
that help answer your question?
The question for Florida.
Yes.
There's been some talk about going to court to challenge the pick of the other database over Fair Health. Do you think that would be useful or hurtful for you guys?
The legal challenge was for Fair Health to challenge it through the courts, and since they decided not to challenge it, now we're just evaluating what could our next steps be. So no decision yet. But I know there's been a lot of communication, so we're just evaluating options. But Fair Health would be.
And hey, this is Tony Large, to the contract lobbyist. Some of it's going to be a little bit more unique than whether it's Fair Health or HCCI Guru, which was the vendor that was chosen. Florida is actually going to build its own state. Originally, they were calling it an all-payers claim database, but in reality, it's going to be a multi-payers claim database because the legislation we passed last year under a transparency bill specifies which insurers in our state will have to report into that multi-payers claim database. So that's the reason why I think there's a little bit of confusion about what Florida did with choosing a vendor in creating our own state database. So even though I know there's grave concerns that it's HCCI Guru and their connections with Ingenix previously, I think now, you know, we need to be very active in the rulemaking process that's going to, AHCC is going to undertake in developing the rules and guidelines of how this multi-state payer database is going to be used and what it's going to be used for. You know, if it was Fair Health, I'm sure we would have moved forward under the auspices of hoping that database would be used in settling claims disputes. Now that it's a database, the vendor is HCCI Guru, I think we're all skeptical of what that data is going to look like, knowing it's only adjudicated claims and that most of the payers paying in are government payers. So that's the difference. We're not using their national database. Florida is now going to build their own state-specific database. I hope that helps.
So we might have time for one more question on balance billing or comment, but then we should probably move on to Medicaid challenges. So does anyone have one last remark? All right, hearing none, I'm going to move forward to Medicaid challenges. There's been a lot going on in this arena as well in the past few months. Is Mr. Aaron Goldfeld here to talk about the Tennessee triage fee?
I am, Allison. I'm here. Thanks for including me.
Thank you. Take it away.
Thank you. Hi, folks. I'm Aaron Goldfeld. I'm based here in Knoxville, Tennessee. I'm with Team Health. I oversee and head up their advocacy and regulatory operations. And as far as ASAP, I have several functions with ASAP, really, as a business leader. I chair the Medicaid EDPMA ASAP Medicaid Joint Task Force. And in that role, my job is to oversee and sort of provide a global view of state activities related to Medicaid, particularly in reimbursement and payment issues, and trying to challenge poor payer behavior, some of the issues that we encounter with respect to non-emergent services or determinations of non-emergent services, and then mobilize a team sort of as a strike force to be able to work with the state ASAP chapters and provide resources and support data and tools, toolkit tools that we can use in sort of mobilizing an effort to challenge state Medicaid agencies and the managed care payers that are contracted with those agencies, challenging those payment policies. Additionally, I am the incoming chair of the ASAP Emergency Medicine Action Fund, and that's a aggregation of various ASAP stakeholders who have made pretty sizable contributions to an aggregate advocacy fund, which we then use to dole out very specific and very highly tailored projects related to supporting and advocating on behalf of emergency medicine. So there's opportunity there as well, and some funding to be able to be supportive in a financial way to some of these efforts that are going on and challenging poor payer behavior. Allison had asked me to take a couple of minutes and just talk to you about some of the work that we're doing in that context, but also specific to Tennessee and some of the activities here. Here in Tennessee, we've had a non-emergent screening policy probably now going on about 5, maybe even 7 years. The policy is administered by one of three managed care organizations that are contracted with the state Medicaid agency, the 10 Care Bureau, and they each payer has developed their own list of diagnoses that they have determined to be emergent. So there's really no such thing as a non-emergent policy. It's a function of emergent diagnoses. And there are some very elaborate, very extensive lists that each payer has developed, Blue Cross, United, and the Aetna plan have developed in administering these programs. Interestingly, not all, each list is different. Each list changes year to year, so there's really no sort of static state by which this program exists, and we're continually being challenged by the dynamics of this program, and that the diagnoses change year to year as to what's emergent and what's not. From the reimbursement perspective, we have negotiated with the governor's office. The governor here in this state, been in office, he's a second term governor, and he's been receptive to our issues, and was receptive to the extent that he was unwilling to advocate on our behalf for doing away with the program. He did support us in finding a reimbursement mechanism or an amount, a dollar amount, that we could collectively sort of say reluctantly okay to acceptance of the program. And what we've done is we've established a base funding of $50 for any diagnosis that is considered non-emergent. And it's certainly not great, but it's certainly not as bad as it could be, in that we've seen programs in certain states where non-emergent services could be paid as low as a level one office visit, which is as low as $15, sometimes even lower. So we take $50 as sort of a half a win, and we've been advocating each year over year to preserve that $50. Now, when the governor leaves office next year in Tennessee, that's going to be a challenge for us, because we're going to have to go into a new administration and explain to that administration and ultimately to the legislature of the virtues of paying that $50 when state legislators can look over to border states and see payments as low as $13. So that's our effort there, is to preserving the $50, trying to find some sort of static state by which the diagnoses list don't change year over year, and that's been our big challenge in addressing that. The payers seem to take the position that they have the latitude and responsibility to be able to make those lists dynamic and change year over year, and we have big objections with that. My sort of request to this group is in the role that I play as far as chair of the Joint Task Force and being able to offer you guys some sort of support and resources, potentially even financial resources, in combating the programs that are in your state. The challenge is identifying when these programs come up. And most of the time we get wind of programs really on the back end of the claims adjudication process, when we see a payment may have been billed out, a claim may have been billed out a level 4 or 5, and it comes back paid at $13. And that's kind of how we get triggered into this understanding that it even exists. So, we've had instances where we've had the opportunity to mobilize and bring some resources into a state, most recently this summer in West Virginia. And I've had a conversation with folks on this call in Kentucky about opportunities to engage with the leadership of the Medicaid agencies in their state. So my ask to this group is see if you can get access to claims data. Talk to your billing companies, talk to your group representatives, your administrators, and see if there's an opportunity to kind of understand the data and see what's coming out of the Medicaid agencies, particularly at the MCO level, at the payer level, and help us, you know, key us in on issues that you're finding with non-emergent services. Generally, these are diagnoses that trigger a denial on the claim form or on the EOB that says, member has utilized the emergency department for services that are non-emergent or not of an emergency nature, and consequently they pay at a default rate. And let us know about these things. And then I think it's important for us as a task force to be able to come together and collectively strategize on what the next best course of action is, what resources can we use, support of prudent layperson standards, challenging payer behaviors that we think are onerous or impermissible with state and federal guidelines. But the first key to all of this is data and communication. So I'm here available. Allison can circulate my contact information. I would welcome anybody to call me directly if they have any questions or have any other thoughts or additional comments they want to make with respect to sort of mobilizing in the sense of creating a strike force or task force in their state to challenge policies that crop up. And just, you know, be visible and be available. And I look forward to working with this group.
Hi, this is Ashley Melendez from Kentucky. Can I ask a question about your $50 reimbursement fee?
Yeah, sure.
Are they basing that on a discharge diagnosis or presenting symptoms? What are they deeming non-emergent?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the policy is supposed to be presenting symptoms, presenting diagnosis. That's not always the case. And we find that many instances we're challenging adjudications that are reflective of discharge diagnosis. So I think you have to be very vigilant about that and challenge these things where you're questioning whether or not the claim has been adjudicated based on presenting symptoms and presenting diagnosis.
When you negotiated that, did you negotiate it based on presenting symptoms?
Yes. Yeah,
okay.
We look to prudent layperson, you know, and we really stay close to the language in prudent layperson, which is reflective of presenting.
Okay, thank you.
Payers may not always observe abide by that, so I think that's where the vigilance comes in.
Thank you.
Now, if I remember, Ashley, we talked about this a couple weeks ago. The plan that's in place in Kentucky is really hospital-driven only, right? There's no
Right now it is, but that's apt to change based on our governor and the new changes in the law.
Yeah, and I think
Ashley
is well founded. I think that's right. You need to be aware of that.
Ashley, this is Steve Anderson from Washington State. I think it's critical that you bring that up because Maria Raven has a great article that shows that 10% of people triaged at level one or level five, depending on what you're talking about, end up getting admitted, and up to 5% of those are into the ICU. So the idea of using discharge diagnosis doesn't work. You have to be real careful even with presenting diagnosis because some of those people are really sick.
Thanks, Dave. I agree.
On a similar note, I want to give us a chance to talk about the Missouri situation. We'll have a chance at the end of this section to talk about this more in general. But I believe we have Ms. Lubert from the Missouri chapter to talk about what happened in Missouri recently.
Yes, I am here for that. So I am the executive director of MOSEP, and our president was unable to attend, so I am going to provide just a brief update. Last fall, we became aware of a proposal to reduce low acuity ED visits that was placed in a line of the FY17 Missouri Medicaid budget. And the plan would cut payments to hospitals and scold patients for coming to the ED for non-emergent issues. And I use the word scold because that's actually the word that the Medicaid director used in his conversations with us. And so we have been working with the Missouri Hospital Association and the State Medical Association on an alternative plan similar to the ERAs for emergencies from Washington State and other states that have successfully implemented this. As a group, we presented our proposal to the Medicaid director, and after some discussion, he did want to incorporate both plans into the FY17 program. However, he didn't feel like ours was a replacement for their plan, which is what we were wanting him to do. We didn't feel like you could successfully get all the hospitals on board implementing both of these plans, so we were wanting our plan to basically replace the proposal that they had in place. November elections brought a new governor to Missouri from the opposite party, and so therefore our Medicaid director left at the end of 2016, and no replacement has been named as of now. And for that reason, implementation of MoHealthNet, the Medicaid proposal, is not likely to happen until a new director is named, and that could be several months away. And then by the time they get into place and kind of get a feel for what's going on, it could be up to 6 months before they're able to actually move forward on that. So during that time, we're continuing to finalize our proposal and attempt to remove this line item from the FY18 fiscal year budget that will start in July. And we're also having some with instrumental state leaders and talking with our proposal over the budget that was proposed, or the proposal that Medicaid had. Does that provide enough information? Does anybody have any questions on specifics?
I think that was a great summary of your situation, and just shows that we're continuing to see similar themes pop up in states around the country, which is why calls like this are so important. So if there's no questions on that specific proposal, we'll move onward with Dr. Lindsay Weaver talking about the experience with Indiana's Medicaid expansion and the ED, which we're particularly excited to hear about, given Seema Verma's position out of Indiana and then coming up as a potential CMS leader for all of us in the country. Dr. Weaver?
Yes. Hello, everybody. Okay, so HIP 2.0, Healthy Indiana Plan, is our Medicaid expansion plan. I think the key point to understand about it is that they really wanted the patients in the Medicaid plan to provide some money, some skin in the game, as they said here in Indiana, into the plan. So there's a couple different levels. The HIP basic plan is basically where they have co-payments for a bunch of different things. The HIP plus, which everybody is eligible to get into, the only thing they have a co-payment for is for non-emergent emergency department visits. So the based on their income, everyone is given a certain amount that they're supposed to put into their power account, which is essentially a health savings account every single month. And the government puts in the rest of the money up to $2,500 is how that works. As far as the non-emergent visits, it is supposed to be based on prudent layperson, and the money is collected by the hospital. So the insurance company minuses that amount from their what they're going to pay for that patient's visit, and the hospital has to go after that. So the hospital has to decide whether they felt like it met prudent layperson, and then obviously the insurance company, Medicaid, or one of the other managed care plans that are part of the Medicaid expansion would look at that as well. So how it's affected us individually, I will say that more of our patients are, they have insurance now, and we're able to get them insurance, so that's helpful. As you probably are not surprised, quite frequently we're not able to collect, or the hospitals are not able to collect that money for the non-emergent co-payment. However, the few people at the different hospitals since I talked to you all said we're happy to get something anyway, because they are getting some form of payment. And so they're not surprised that they're not able to collect those co-payments. Those co-payments do not come out of the power account. That has to come from the individual patient. It's $8 for the first non-emergent visit, and then it's $25 for subsequent over a 12-month period. So again, I'm happy to answer any questions on that.
Lindsay, this is Aaron Goldfield. Thanks for the update. Very helpful. Quick question for you would be, who is making the determination on the emergent or non-emergent nature of the case, and is it based off of any sort of diagnoses list, or what is the source for that determination?
They're using the same prudent layperson that they used for our previous Medicaid billing, basically. Like Anthem, for instance, is one of the managed care organizations as part of the Medicaid expansion. So they, on their end, will decide based on their prudent layperson criteria whether that visit met that, and then they will not. They'll subtract that copayment amount from what they send in payment. So the hospitals are trying to ask for payments upfront based on the visit, and then other ones are just when they see that they don't get that part of the bill, then they're going to they bill the patient to ask for that copayment.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Hearing no other immediate questions for Dr. Weaver, we'll move on to Dr. Steven Anderson to talk about Washington's experience, and then we should have a brief time to wrap up with further questions about Medicaid before we need to move on to opioid prescribing, which is another hot topic. So, Dr. Anderson.
Thanks, Allison. So, Steve Anderson from Washington State. You may have heard about our battle that started up to 8 years ago, where the state of Washington Medicaid program decided they were going to institute a program where after three visits to the emergency department, if they judged the fourth visit to be non-emergent, they just weren't going to pay for it. We argued that that was a violation of prudent layperson, and we got into about a year-long battle with the state. We tried to negotiate a list for a while, and the list, in order for the state to save money, they had to put things on their list like abdominal pain, chest pain. They put things like sudden loss of vision and hemorrhage with miscarriage on their list because those were big money ticket items. We were willing to give them things like toenail fungus, and you could see that we just weren't reaching a mutual list. My suggestion would be we tried a list for a short period of time. It didn't work. We buried that list. We burned that list. And we moved on to what was called the Washington State 7 Best Practices. But to get there, we actually had to sue the state of Washington's Medicaid program in our state Supreme Court. And we won. We won on a number of different issues, but primarily it was that they hadn't gone through the proper rulemaking. But when we won, we went back to the table and we instituted something called the Washington State 7 Best Practices. And the line I want to leave you with was that it's not about denying access. It's about coordinating care. Because the real money that's spent in Medicaid is not the patient that comes in once in a blue moon for toenail fungus. The money that's spent are the people that come in recurrently for failure to coordinate their ongoing medical problems that we don't cure, we just manage. Their diabetes, their COPD, and their chronic abdominal pain, chronic atypical chest pain. We pointed out to the state that if we could coordinate their care in a better fashion, we'd actually save the state much more money than they would ever save in a program where they denied paying for level one triage items. So we sort of won what we wanted, and out of the process, we ended up getting tools that help us to coordinate their care, things like the emergency department information exchange that upfront tells us how many times people have been to the emergency department and where in the last year. Our PDMP for prescription drug monitoring isn't something we have to access. It's pushed upfront to us in the emergency department. So we know that even when we walk in to talk to the patient. And there are a number of other coordinated facets that have really worked well. in the long run and in a nutshell, and I'm happy to talk to any state individually, this turned out to be win-win-win. Patients were not denied access to the emergency department in any fashion, and we preserved prudent laypersons. That's the most important thing. Second of all, the physicians weren't in a place of not being paid for the efforts that they did. And third, the state, by coordinating those care of their super utilizers, ended up saving $32 million in the first year out of their Medicaid program, which was more than they had anticipated saving had they just not paid the bill. Those savings have continued on in subsequent years. They've brought us goodwill with our state Medicaid program, such that now any program that gets investigated by the state, the first group they invite in is ASAP, Washington ASAP, to talk about how do we save money moving forward. So we managed to avert a list. We managed to get the tools that we actually all want in the emergency department every day. We managed to help coordinate our super utilizers. And it, like I said, it's turned out to be win, win, win. But it wasn't without a lot of work. It involved some lawyers suing the state, et cetera.
So the great brief summary of a complicated and lengthy issue in Washington State. Does anyone have any questions for Dr. Anderson?
Are you willing to travel around the state and tell our other Medicaid departments how to do this?
So we have actually in Washington State held a boot camp for governors, medical divisions to come to Washington State and actually learn from us. We've done that about three or four states at a time have come out. We've done it for about 19 states. I've actually been invited and spoken at probably at least a dozen state chapters on this process, and we're happy to share that. The first place to go to is to go to the WashingtonASAP.org website and look up the Washington State 7 Best Practices. It's a great place to find out about how to coordinate the care of our high utilizers.
This is Ashley again from Kentucky, and I will say all this information that Dr. Anderson has been very helpful. We took it all because our CMS and the state was trying to do this to us, and we took everything they had with the backing of ASAP and said, kind of just bring it on, you know, and set and met with them, and they've dropped it thus far, and it's been a few years, so hopefully, you know, people can have that kind of luck.
That's excellent to hear.
Any other things? Alaska, I would also echo what was just said. Washington was incredibly helpful to us. We passed similar legislation last February in a bill called SB 74, and we were able to take some of the lessons that they learned, such as including the prescription drug monitoring system, and include it into our legislation, which has turned out to be key. So we have legislation passed that's similar that also, again, happy to share, but Washington's foresight and help on this was instrumental.
This is Katie from Oregon, and Washington State also helped us to kill a similar bill. They're awesome.
Thank you all. You guys have all been, some of you have taken it even to the next step. And I give kudos to Anne in Alaska and Sharon at the Oregon program and everything. Some of you guys have even taken it to the next level. Good for you.
And we hope that Missouri will be able to tell a similar story on this call in a year.
That is our goal as well.
Excellent. Glad to hear of such good collaboration. I think that's been a great discussion of some of the Medicaid issues, so I'm going to keep moving forward on to opioid prescribing mandates and limits. And we're going to start out with Dr. Michael Boyd, who works on this with the State Legislative Committee next year and is going to talk a little bit about national trends on these issues.
Yeah, this is Michael Boyd. Thank you very much. And Dr. Anderson provided a very nice segue into my topic here. So I'll present a little bit about the national overview on legislation addressing prescription drug monitoring programs and opioid legislation. So starting off with the PDMPs, 49 states have prescription drug monitoring programs available. The only exception would be Missouri, but they do have some legislation, it looks like, in the books to try to get that started up. Of those 49 states, 28 do have some form of provider use mandate, which would mandate the providers access the PDMP in some situations. Of those 28, 14 states have comprehensive use mandates, and comprehensive mandates mean that providers must look up the patient in the PDMP prior to the initial prescription. So, of course, in the emergency setting, we'd like to think that most of our prescriptions are going to patients we are seeing for the first time, so that comprehensive mandate applies to us in virtually every situation. Of those 14 with the comprehensive mandates, 9 do have exceptions when the prescription is somewhere between 3 and 7 days, and some of the states vary. For instance, Connecticut and Wisconsin provide an exemption that you don't have to look up the PDMP on each patient whenever the prescription is less than 3 days. The 7-day exemption states are Nevada, Ohio, and Tennessee. However, Kentucky, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and West Virginia provide no exceptions at all, meaning that you must look up the patient in the PDMT every single time you prescribe them a prescription. So, of course, ACIP proposed legislation with absolute mandates. We support the PDMTs in their existence, and obviously they have great value to us as a tool, but accessing it prior to every prescription in every single case imposes some workflow interruptions. It's not indicated often, and then there are also some legal ramifications whenever legislation absolutely mandates you use it every single time. So concerning this topic, I've been in touch with Sharon Peters, who is the president of the National Alliance for Model State Drug Laws. And this is a really critical organization for us because they are congressionally funded, and they actually draft the model drug laws, alcohol laws, and policies that are essentially implemented in most states in most instances. So states ask them for help creating their legislation, and their fingerprint is all over most of the current legislation that's out there. So she expressed a great desire to work with us on this issue. And I know we have some lobbyists on the call, so if you want information on how to get in contact with them, I think this would be they'd really be a great partner to work with whenever these PDMP legislative issues arise. She actually agreed with our position that we did not recommend absolute mandates to access it every single time. She would also agree that there should be exemptions in place for circumstances when the PDMP may not be operational. There should also be a phase-in period between the launch of it and the mandate to use it to ensure that it can actually handle the volume, the issues that they would support, that we support as well. In addition, the states that have been most successful have been using a push system rather than a pull system, just as Dr. Anderson described. 14 states have integrated their PDMP into a health IT, meaning that you don't have to separately log in. It's kind of automatically in your EMR whenever you log into it. There also, of course, have been barriers to this. One of the biggest barriers is a legal concern in that some states prohibit the PDMP information from being stored in any sort of template or IT platform outside of the actual PDMP platform. And then another issue would be, how do you ensure that the person in the electronic health record also has authority to view the PDMP? So, for instance, in most states, you have to separately register as a provider for the monitoring program. But if the monitoring program is in the EHR, then any nurse or tech or anybody who has access to the EHR could potentially then look into the PDMP. So that is a privacy login kind of technicality issue that needs to be addressed whenever they're launching the systems. There was, though, a very good there's a pilot study in Indiana that showed that the PDMP was actually linked to the EHR, and the provider satisfaction was 97% with this system as opposed to a system that was a separate login. So that was a pretty good outcome for them. And another room for innovation for the PDMP is in California. They have a enhanced user interface where whenever you log in, rather than looking at the patient individually, if patients have gotten 6 or more prescriptions from 6 or more pharmacies in the past year, those lists of patients are actually automatically uploaded. So instead of searching for them, it's almost like a most wanted list, if you will, of the people who have been abusing the system, so you can find them rather easily. There's been some studies that analyze the effectiveness of it, and they mostly are focusing on the number of prescriptions and pills rather than on the overdose rate or death rate or more clinical outcomes. However, they have shown there have been certainly some benefits. For instance, in New York, the multiple prescriber episodes, meaning five or more prescriptions from five or more pharmacies within 1 month, which is quite a number there in 1 month, that decreased by 91% from 300 patients to 25 patients within the two-year period before the launch of the PMP to after the launch of the PMP. So those super utilizers that we really try to identify, that New York showed that this system certainly helps you identify them. And the PDMP legislation is certainly sweeping across the country, and it seems like the states that have enacted it more recently have also been more strict regarding the mandates to use it. Moving on to the opioid legislation, this is also obviously a very hot topic. The laws concerning opioid limitations have been rapidly expanding. There is no federal law imposing restriction on the duration or supply for Schedule II substances, but 11 states have limits on pill or day quality quantities. Delaware, Illinois, Missouri, Rhode Island, Tennessee, Utah, Jersey, and South Carolina limit the prescriptions to 30-day supply. Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Pennsylvania limit to 7 days. And in Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Pennsylvania, they've all enacted these laws within the last 2 years. So again, the cases or the states where they're having more recent legislation are also a little bit more strict. Connecticut does allow a exemption to the 7-day supply if the provider documents some medical rationale as to why they're prescribing more than 7 days. And in Massachusetts, the 7-day supply is only to those receiving an opiate for the first time from that provider. But in the ER, that, again, is most of our patients. However, Pennsylvania was really the most stringent on this, and they just came out with a law in November 2016, only 2 months ago. And the law is actually entitled Regulating the Prescribing of Controlled Substances in Hospital Emergency Departments. So it singled out emergency providers amongst all of the physicians just in the title of the law itself. It was signed in 2016, and it limits the duration to 7 days with no exceptions. So really practically, the 7-day limit is probably not a big practice changer. And across the country, any day limit maybe doesn't change our practice that much. Very few times are we providing more than 7 days from the ER. But in the law, just in the title, single out emergency departments, I think that kind of adds to this perception that, you know, the ER docs are the ones handing out these opioids willy-nilly to everybody. And that's really not the message that we'd want our lawmakers to send to the public. So it's more of a public opinion type ramification than an actual practice changer for us whenever they come up with these very strict day limits. And most of the day limits, though, do include exceptions for cancer and terminal illness and hospice patients. So instead of like pill and day limits, I think we support legislation that's more along the lines of like the lowest effective dose for the shortest duration possible, or the amount sufficient to treat the current episode of care, rather than very strict 3, 5, 7 day arbitrary limits that kind of can set us up for legal problems if we happen to advance that in an extenuating circumstance. So if anyone has any questions on this, I'd be happy to answer, especially if you want the contact information for the National Alliance for Model State Drug Laws. They were actually really looking forward to working with us as these laws advance in other states, and I think they'd be a great resource for us to utilize.
Hi, this is Amy from Virginia. I'm the contract lobbyist there, and I had a question for you. We are potentially seeing a bill here in Virginia that's going to limit it to 3 days in the emergency department specifically. And so what you're saying sounds like no other states have anything that strict. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. Yeah, the most I've found is 7 days. Some of the PDMP exemptions exempt you if you're doing only up to 3 days, but the Massachusetts, Connecticut, and PA are 7.
Okay. Thank you.
This is Hunter Jensen from Pennsylvania. Just to do a couple clarifications and just to give you guys what happened in our state, we were essentially, this came down from the governor's office, and we were told we could either get behind it or be run over, essentially. The initial bill asked that if a provider would not do 7 days, they would be found for, quote, unprofessional conduct, which we spent a lot of time taking out of our bill. It also asks that, it asked initially that every patient who got opioids would be referred to treatment. which we were able to get out of the bill. We did add a section on liability so that providers who follow this legislation do not can be immune from civil liability, which we thought was a win. And just for clarification, there is an exemption in our bill. It is for an acute medical crisis or cancer, or I think it was acute medical crisis, cancer, and palliative care. So we were able to win that back in the bill. That had been taken out multiple times by multiple legislatures and the governor's office, and we really fought pretty hard to do that. So we had a real tough time with this. We interacted with multiple legislatures as well as the governor's office multiple times about this. This was a real priority for our governor to get passed.
And to reiterate that Pennsylvania did a phenomenal job fighting for those clarifications. And even if you can correct me if I'm wrong, but there was initially you were supposed to check the PDMP prior to providing even within the emergency room. So you couldn't, you know, give someone a dose of morphine for their femur fracture unless you checked the prescription drug monitoring program beforehand, which seemed to be ridiculous.
Correct.
And that was also taken out of the law. So you did a great job fighting for all those exemptions.
It was interesting to us because this really started as a smaller thing and really snowballed because of the opioid crisis. It became really good hot button political information for both the legislature and the governors, and we really had to look for our wins where we could get them as opposed to the actual bill itself.
In Pennsylvania, there still is not a exemption for the PDMP lookup every time. That is still correct. Is that right?
That's correct. Every prescription from the emergency department requires a PDMP lookup, as does any patient in observation status in the hospital.
This is Ashley in Kentucky again, and I don't know if you have ours right in front of you. Ours passed, the law passed in 2012, which I was intimately involved with, but now it's been 4 years and I'm on to other things. But I think that ours, we have to look it up. No matter who we prescribe it to leave the ED. And I believe we have to, it's a 3-day maximum that we can give in Kentucky for ER prescribing of opioids. It's really bad. Now, what we could do is we can proxy like the secretaries to look them up for the physicians. The physicians themselves do not have to look up everyone. Our secretaries and the ED are proxied on the system to look them up. So that does help.
Right. Yeah, most states do a lot. Over 80% of states allow what they call delegates to look up on behalf of the providers. They allow a nurse or pharmacy technician or someone to look up the PDMP instead of the provider itself. So that's 80% of states allow that. And you are right with your PDMP. It is 100% every single time you must look it up for every prescription in Kentucky.
This is Uncor Doshi from Pennsylvania again. Just to clarify, how we have a lot of – we have the same ability to have a delegate look it up, and most of our emergency departments are having a difficult time figuring out how to do that. How does that actually work in Kentucky and other states? Does the secretary look up everybody who comes in or only when they're writing a prescription? How do they decide this?
Only the physician, the provider will – tell us, they'll put in an order, and when the order is put in our EMR, the secretary will look it up.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. You can call me offline if you'd like. Ashley@Louisville.edu is my email, A-S-H-L-E-E.
Dr. Doshi, while we've been talking
on the board
about
in Texas. Okay, sorry, I was going to say, I log on to the prescription database, like it takes me 30 seconds. I used it last night for 4 different patients, and I found it extremely helpful and user-friendly.
Unfortunately, a lot of different states have different programs that aren't that easy.
Right. It's been a change for Texas in the past couple of years, though. It didn't used to be so easy, so it's good to see that states are changing and getting better software and evolving. Well, we've been talking about Pennsylvania. I want to move on to Dr. Doshi talking about Pennsylvania's warm handoff program. We're starting to run a little behind, so I want to make sure we have a chance to talk about everything on the agenda and give Dr. Pettigrew an opportunity to talk about Georgia if he's been able to join us. So let's talk about the warm handoff program in Pennsylvania.
Okay, thanks. Sorry, well, I'll be brief. One of our priorities legislatively was that not only do we need to worry about how we prescribe opioids, but how we actually take our patients and transition them to the appropriate resources. This is not something that we have in place in Pennsylvania, although we have been very successful with our Department of Drug and Alcohol programs on at least deciding that this is an agenda item. We have helped draft some model information on how this can occur and have discussed it with the DDAP. Right now it's in their hands, reportedly to be sent out to all of the counties. This will be county specific and county run. And we're still waiting for how that's going to come back and how different regions will be able to have tailored resources for patients after their emergency department visit for help with detoxification and rehabilitation programs. So that's kind of where we are. It's not really fleshed out right now. We're trying to see where this is going to go. But we have been at the table from the very beginning, which has been really important.
That's excellent. It's great to see a state being proactive on the other end of this issue as well.
Will we be able to get that information?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what someone said.
I'm sorry, do you think that you'd be willing to share that information with Harry to send out to us? This is Amy from Virginia.
Yeah, once we get it compiled, which shouldn't be too long, we'll be happy to send it out. We actually have some meetings coming up, so we'll see what that is, and we'll send it out to everyone.
Yeah, that'd be really helpful. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Excellent. Does anyone else have any other opioid prescribing or PDMP issues that they want to bring up from their state?
I guess this is Toni Large, the contract lobbyist from Florida. I just want to let y'all know that we have a bill that just recently has been filed and being pushed pretty hard by some parent advocates in the state who've had children that are adult children, really, adult patients that have come in with overdosing. And, of course, we've made efforts in our state to have naloxone readily available to not only the patient but caregivers. Now they've gone a step further because they realize most of those patients are showing up multiple times for drug overdoses. And the bill, unfortunately, once the ER doc, once the adult patient comes in, overdosing, to do really three things. The first would be to notify the adult patient next of kin that they came in and were overdosing. The next is to notify the patient's primary care doctor that came in overdosing. And the third would be to also notify any physician who's written a prescription for opioids in the last 12 months to also be notified by that emergency physician before we can discharge the patient. So, of course, that's pretty alarming. It's funny, some of the things that the other side says would be a deterrent, of course, that wouldn't be a route to go, such as maybe law enforcement playing a role, because that might deter people from coming into the ER. We tried to say to them that us notifying adult patients' parents might also deter people from using the ER. There's multiple reasons that are alarming. We also said, well, maybe another option would be looking at the PDMP and how do you maybe put some kind of flag on a patient who has come in at least once or multiple times on a drug overdose. And they said, oh, no, that would be a privacy concern. Well, ironically, we did them kind of tough for us not to have the same privacy concerns for an adult patient that comes in, because how are we going to know who their next of kin or their parents are unless we're, getting that information from the parent themselves? And what if we notify the wrong parent or the wrong next of kin and the liability that goes along with that? So just wanted to alert everyone that it seems like some advocates, so well-intended, have taken it kind of to the next level.
Well, maybe if we can get the warm handoffs program up and running, it can be an example of an alternative that's more helpful, more practical to help our patients, but that is certainly some alarming legislation. All right, I want to move on for Harry Monroe and Lauren Myers to talk about the Phone to Action program and the New Jersey experience. So we'll start with Mr. Monroe.
And I will attempt to be very brief. Phone to Action has been rolled out within the last year, and it's a service offering for state chapter advocacy efforts. It's also used for federal efforts as well. But in terms of state chapters, the point is to be able to contact state legislators or other government officials, not only by email, which can be important, but also through other social media means such as Twitter, Facebook, or also phone calls. So it's an outstanding tool that can be used, can be helpful with advocacy efforts. When we rolled it out, we attempted to do so for our chapters in a way that would make sense for chapters of various sizes that would be using it with different levels of frequency. And so for chapters that believe that you would be using it on a frequent basis, we rolled it out with a price of $1,000 for an entire year. And with that, you can use it as frequently as you choose to do so. For smaller chapters that think they might have a one-time need based on a piece of legislation that's out there, we rolled it out with a per-use price of $250 so that a chapter that only has a one-time need can do that. So anyway, if you have questions about the pricing or signing up for it, feel free to reach out to me. I asked Lauren to speak to it because they recently used it for the first time in New Jersey, and I understand they had a good experience with it. So with that, I'll turn it over to Lauren.
Thanks, Harry. I'm Lauren Myers with the New Jersey chapter of ASEP, the executive director, also with Maryland ASEP, but I've only used it so far with the New Jersey chapter. I found it to be very effective. It was very user-friendly. They were very helpful throughout the whole process. I created my wording. I went in, you know, they set up the, they did a training and demo with me, and then I created my wording for the campaign. We used ours on the out-of-network reform legislation campaign. The biggest obstacle I found, the training was a week before I actually enacted my campaign. The biggest obstacle I found at the time was getting the advocates, because you have to have those in your database before you can really send it out. So I sent a mass email to my membership once the campaign was created. It was very simple for them to use. All they had to do was type in their name, their email address, their phone number, and their zip code, and everything was done for them. I selected that this was state only. You can select state, federal. You can go to your councilman. It goes to all different branches, which is nice. I did state only. One thing that would have been helpful that we didn't really have time for is if we did more of an advanced target option, which they do have as an option, but we had to get this out pretty fast. It would have been helpful if it went just to the committee as opposed to, or if it went in addition to their legislators, to also the committee that was working on the out-of-network. But we had 192 connections. It went to the full membership. 66 advocates signed on. And I know that when we use this in the future, which we will most likely have to do, we'll already have a good base to start a new campaign.
That's excellent. I'm glad to hear you had a good experience with it. The clock is running down, so I'm going to ask to see if Dr. Pettigrew is on the call before I ask for comments on the phone to action issue. We'll kind of close with that. Dr. Pettigrew, are you here to talk about the Georgia experience? I'm not hearing him. It sounds like his meeting with the legislator might have run over, which hopefully is a good thing. I think others who might have represented what's going on in Georgia are also in that meeting. Is there anyone else from Georgia that I'm not aware of who's here that would want to talk about Georgia's experience? All right. Hearing none, I can tell you that they are just very actively involved in working on some balance billing legislation in their state. But I think that many of the issues that they're addressing were discussed when we had numerous states, Colorado, Alaska, New Jersey, Ohio, Oregon, Florida, talk about the experience they're having. So hopefully everyone feels like that issue was well covered. And if you have any questions or comments, please reach out to Harry or myself. We're very eager to help all the states that are facing these challenges. So does anyone have any comments on the phone to action program? Any questions for Mr. Monroe or Ms. Myers? All right, hearing none, are there any other state advocacy updates in general that anyone wants to share that don't fit the topics that we selected for this call? All right, I think that was enough time for everyone to come off of mute. So hopefully that means that folks' questions were answered. Oh, we have one person.
Okay. Well, thank you all for joining us on the call. We really appreciate your time and hope to see many of you at LAC. And please reach out if you have questions or concerns in the interim. Have a great afternoon.